Now
on News Talk 105.9 WMAL.
The Saturday Morning Update.
Good morning. It is the Saturday Morning Update. I'm Rick Fowler. Thank you for being with us. Jeff Wolf behind the console, Jane Houghton, our producer this morning, and we are covering two stories of importance, including, of course, the latest on Ukraine and the latest on the People's Convoy, the truckers to arrive in the Washington area today. They were at Hagerstown last night, and Heather Curtis and Michelle Murray will be keeping tabs on the latest progress as they enter the Washington area throughout the morning here on WMAL. Of course, the major story of the week and what will be the major story of the year, if not the decade, and that is the Russian invasion on Ukraine. The tragedy continues. It's day 10 of that Russian invasion. We have seen horrific images of homes and apartment buildings being destroyed. We're seeing these huge explosions throughout the wee hours of the morning and overnight in Ukraine, but we're not seeing on U.S. television the images of the death and injury that goes along with it. We're not seeing the bodies. And it's the sanitized approach to covering this war in Ukraine. And I think if we were to see more of that imagery, not that anyone has that desire, but if it were more obvious as to that death and destruction, there might be a little more of an outcry. There might be something more we can do. People are calling for a no-fly zone. We'll get into that this morning with Tony Schaefer and KT McFarland. I think there's a general sentiment that we just wish there was more that could be done, and why isn't more being done? That's something we're going to be talking about this morning with a number of our experts. And what's next? What can we do next? Now, one thing that will happen this morning, there will be a virtual meeting of President Volodymyr Zelensky with members of the U.S. Senate. They've been invited to participate in that meeting at 9:30 this morning. All of the U.S. Senate has been invited to join in. Now, the death toll, surprisingly low at this point, as the reports are coming in. They're saying at least 227 civilians have been killed, along with another 525 injured in Ukraine. That's from the United Nations Human Rights Office. But when you look at those apartment buildings that are destroyed, so many of them destroyed, the homes going up in flames, I think that reporting may be somewhat behind, and that as more emergency personnel go in, as more people go through the rubble, that death toll will be going up in Ukraine. On Friday, the White House confirmed that the Vice President, Kamala Harris, will be traveling to Poland and Romania next week. She will visit Poland on Monday. American troops are stationed to assist with refugees fleeing from Ukraine. They're there in Poland. Now, one of the issues that we see here, one of the surprising developments, is the president of Ukraine, Volodymyr Zelensky, is able to do press conferences. He's able to address his people. He's out in the street, and he's had reportedly three Russian hit squads out after him, at least that they know of, but he continues. He did a virtual address, and we've got some sound of a crowd in Prague. It's just the sound of tens of thousands of people across Europe who are showing their support for President Zelensky and the people of Ukraine. And this is just a little bit of what that sounds like, the crowds in Prague as they were addressed by President Zelensky. And I think that speaks for all of us, the support that we wish we could do more for the Ukraine people. And as we hear some of the sounds of the past couple days, I think Congressman Michael McCaul kind of sums it up for us. He was speaking on Fox yesterday.
We need some imagination and some spine. You know, right now we got 40 miles of a convoy of all of their tanks. They're really, you know, here sitting ducks. Why can't we come up with some plan to take them out? We have to have the rhetoric, the messaging, but we also need the weapons and the power.
And I think he speaks for all of us. What more can we do? Well, Lindsey Graham had an idea. You heard about it at the top of the hour. And we'll play the clip that has gotten him a lot of criticism among his peers, including Republicans. And here's what he said.
How does this end? Somebody in Russia has to step up to the plate. Is there Brutus in Russia? Is there a more successful Colonel Stauffenberg in the Russian military? The only way this ends, my friend, is for somebody in Russia to take this guy out. You would be doing your country a great service and the world a great service.
Well, the White House walked that one back for Lindsey Graham pretty quickly yesterday.
It's not the position of the United States government, and certainly not a statement you'd hear come from the mouth of anybody working in this administration.
So a lot of the concern among the politicians and the American people, for that matter, are the questions of oil sanctions and why are we still buying Russian oil? Well, that question was asked of Jen Psaki at the White House yesterday.
We don't have a strategic interest in reducing the global supply of energy, and that would raise prices at the gas pump for the American people around the world. Well, there are 9,000 approved oil leases that the oil companies are not tapping into currently.
Is there nothing that the administration can do to get those providers back to pre-pandemic levels?
Do you think the oil companies don't have enough money to drill on the places that have been pre-approved?
Ooh, a little testy there from Ms. Psaki. Well, that wasn't the only time that Jackie Heinrich at Fox asked Jen Psaki about it.
As long as we're buying Russian oil, though, aren't we financing the war?
Well, Jackie, again, it's only about 10% of what we're importing. I've not made any announcement about any decision on that front, but our objective here and our focus is making sure that any step we take maximizes the impact on President Putin and minimizes it on the American people. And anyone who's calling for an end to the carve-out should be clear that that would raise prices.
Nancy Pelosi begs to differ with Jen Psaki. She was asked about it. Nancy Pelosi was pretty concise.
There's been a push by some Democrats to ban the import of Russian oil. Where do you stand?
I'm all for that. Ban it.
Ban the oil.
Ban the oil come from Russia. Yep.
All right. It's the first time I've agreed with her in 15 years. Joe Manchin was also asked about it. And here's what Senator Manchin had to say about the weaponization of oil.
Russia has weaponized energy. They will not just stop with Ukraine. They'll use it wherever it's advantageous. We have to have energy independent. You cannot be the superpower of the world if you have to depend on other nations to produce your energy. And I'm just in a different place than my caucus or the colleagues or the president, and they have a hard time coming to grips that you've got to use everything you've got.
And that's Senator Joe Manchin, of course, of West Virginia. And those are just some of the sounds of the past 24 hours. We're now at 6:17, time for a check of the traffic and weather. And then we'll be back and we'll get the very latest on COVID-19. Whatever happened to COVID? We're going to talk to Dr. Bob Lahida because I think that is of importance as well. That's next. But first, here's Michelle Murray.
On 270 northbound at Shady Grove Road, construction reported along the left side. So far, that's not causing any delays. In Tyson's Corner, watch out for long-term construction that has the roadway narrowed westbound on 7 between the Dulles Toll Road and the Georgetown Pike. On the outer loop of the Beltway and Allentown Road, a work zone in the left lane, but that is not causing delays. Now from GarageDrainPair.com, the WML Stormwatch 7 forecast.
Temperatures will really warm as we head towards the weekend highs today into the low and mid-60s. We will see some morning clouds followed by afternoon sunshine. Later on tonight, mostly cloudy skies. Low temperatures not really going to drop, mainly into the 50s to near 60 degrees. For your Sunday, very warm. Temperatures in the mid-70s under mostly cloudy skies. Have the chance for some isolated showers. Better chance for rain as we head towards Monday, late afternoon and evening. Ahead of a cold front, high temperatures on Monday near 80 degrees. I'm 7 News meteorologist Alex Liggett in the Stormwatch 7 Weather Center.
34 degrees in the nation's capital. It's 6:18 on the Saturday morning update.
News Talk 105.9 WMAL.
Making sense of the news.
Thank you for being with us on the Saturday morning update. With the focus of the news on Ukraine and Europe and Russia, we're not hearing as much about COVID, and there have been stories about the masks coming off around the country, but where are we really on all of this? Well, we thought we'd go to the expert, Dr. Bob Lahida, the director of St. Joseph's Institute for Autoimmune and Rheumatic Diseases. He is the author of Immunity Strong, boost your natural healing power and live to 100. It's just been out first of the year. And Dr. Lajita, thank you for being back with us.
It's good to be with you, Rick. I mean, this has been quite a journey, hasn't it?
Well, it seems we're on a little smoother path in the journey at this point. A question for you. It seems like there is a national sentiment that we're out of the woods and the masks are coming off. There's been a lot of pressure to take those masks off. So my question to you is, are we out of the woods, or is this just we're all tired of it, so we're going to move forward whether we're out of it or not?
Well, it's a little bit of both. We're out of the woods for sure, because over 75% of the country is vaccinated, and the rest of the country, or the good part of the country, has actually had natural infection. And the natural infection is very, very positive. It gives your immune system a lot, and it may in some cases be actually better than the vaccine. So in that regard, we are out of the woods here, but there are other pockets around the world which are still roaring, and some of them are having major spikes, like New Zealand and the Caribbean countries, etc. So, you know, we're not totally, totally out of the woods. The other thing, Rick, is we have to remember we still have the immunosuppressed, we still have the elderly, and we still have those with many, many comorbidities, severe diabetes, lung disease, heart disease. These are the people that will have to continue to wear masks and continue to be careful.
Periodically in the news, we'll hear of another variant that's been discovered, and then we don't hear too much more about it. Would you envision that there are any variants that have been identified on the horizon?
Well, not on the horizon. There are variants like BA1 and BA2 that have been identified, but they have been found to be inconsequential. They're a super variant of the Omicron virus that, as you know, affects the upper respiratory system and instead of the lower respiratory system. The Delta was the lower respiratory system, which wreaked havoc and killed so many people. The Omicron is largely upper respiratory, so, you know, congestion, sore throat, fever, but nothing really that is super deadly, as we saw earlier in the pandemic with the Delta variants and the Alpha variants and all the early cases. Doubtless, there's still a possibility for new variants at any time, but we're very, very vigilant. Everybody's watching, and it doesn't seem likely that that's going to happen. But, you know, you want to never say never. And we may have variants going forward, but I hope not. I doubt it. It would have to be a very immune evasive variant with high infectivity.
Now that there's been a little more time for study, is there one booster that might be recommended over others at this point?
I'm sitting here with a booster chart. I think all three vaccines, Pfizer's, BioNTech, Moderna, and J&J, are all sufficient. And I think you can mix and match. If you got the Pfizer two shots, you can get the J&J booster. If you got the J&J one shot, you can get the Moderna booster. So it's not really where you're nailing down one type of vaccine. Actually, this chart says if you've gotten the J&J, you can get the Pfizer or Moderna booster greater than or equal to 2 months after the primary immunization. So these boosters are very much available. They're highly recommended for people who are at great risk. And by great risk, I mean people who are healthcare workers. We're trying to get rid of our masks, believe it or not. But healthcare workers, police, fire, EMS, and people who serve the public in trains, buses, airplanes, and also supermarkets. So that's probably my message today.
And we're hearing that now there's the possibility that we'll have testing and then an immediate prescription of a treatment. What is the very latest on treatment?
Well, that's the test and treat, which means if you've got symptoms, you get tested, you're positive, you can use the antiviral drugs, the most popular being Paxlovid, which is the Pfizer drug. And this cuts hospitalizations by 90%. So this is really a very effective drug. The problem is I was trying to locate Paxlovid in local pharmacies, and I had some difficulty doing that. They're not quite distributed to every pharmacy in the country yet, but that is going to happen according to our CDC, that you will be treated as soon as you test positive. Now, the Merck Molnupiravir is a similar agent, which is also an antiviral. It can be given to you as well after you've proven to be positive with symptoms, and that drug is also efficient, but not to the degree that the Paxlovid is. The data show that the Molnupiravir is about 50% effective in cutting hospitalizations and ICU admissions.
And finally, your book, Immunity Strong, Boost Your Natural Healing Power and Live to 100. What would you summarize as kind of the key point that you make in the book?
The key point that I make is that your immune system is under your control, and that the elimination of stress and the elimination of external poisons like alcohol, I mean, not total elimination. We, of course, all love to have a cocktail every now and then or a glass of wine. But if you're a smoker or an alcoholic and your epigenetic effects from your diet, your environment, really, really affect you adversely, and the brain, off and on, the brain, mind, and spirit controls immune function, and therefore you control immune function, and you are the one who lowers your resistance, and you can do that in a variety of ways. It's all in the book. But you can also strengthen your immune system in the same way with vitamin D, vitamin C, zinc, other antioxidants that you can take. And I'm not one of these alternative care doctors. I really never got into this until I started researching material for this book. But I have to tell you, there's a great deal that everybody can do, especially if you've got long-haul syndrome. And I guess we could talk about that in a subsequent show. But that is very, very important. Diet and nutrition, eliminating stress and making sure that your nutrition is good and that you are taking care of your microbiome and your bowel. All of that will promote a good, healthy life as you get older.
Dr. Bob Lahida, very much appreciated. Thank you.
Thanks, Rick.
626, it is the Saturday Morning Update on WMAL. Coming up on the program, of course, we'll have Jennifer Harper, and we're going to get into a number of the polls after the president's performance in the past week or so. We'll also be talking with Jim Trusty. He has the very latest on the findings of the January 6th committee up on Capitol Hill, the House investigation into the January 6th riot. They're talking about criminal activity of Donald Trump. Well, let's see how sensational that headline and claim is. We'll talk to Jim Trusty about that. Also on the way, John Gizzi joins us. He'll have a very interesting look, insight into President Zelensky of Ukraine, and quite an interesting history on President Zelensky for a fairly young guy, and that's coming up. Also, Cheryl Atkinson will join us, and Cheryl's got an interesting read on the reporting of the war in Ukraine. Lieutenant Colonel Tony Schaefer joins us, of course, and we'll get into some of the military aspects of the Russian invasion, and then KT McFarland will put it all in perspective for us as well. So it's all coming up here on the Saturday Morning Update.
News Talk 105.9 WMAL.
Making sense of the news.
In the news at 6:30, Russian state media is reporting that Russia's military will begin a temporary ceasefire in two areas of Ukraine to allow civilians to evacuate. It would be the first breakthrough in allowing people to escape the war. The Russian Defense Ministry says it agreed on evacuation routes with Ukrainian forces to allow civilians to leave the strategic port of Mariupol in the southeast. The vaguely worded statement did not make clear how long the routes would remain open. Ukraine has called the need for humanitarian corridors, quote, question number one amid fears of food shortages. The office of President Emmanuel Macron says that France will soon propose concrete measures to ensure the safety and security of Ukraine's five nuclear sites. The safeguards will be drawn up on the basis of the International Atomic Energy Agency criteria, that statement from the French president today. A Russian attack on a nuclear plant sparked a fire on Friday, briefly raised worldwide fears of a catastrophe. The statement said Macron is, quote, extremely concerned about the risks to nuclear safety, security, and the implementation of international safeguards resulting from the Russian invasion of Ukraine. And former Vice President Mike Pence is urging Republicans to move on from the 2020 election. He's declaring that, quote, there is no room in this party for apologists for Putin, as he further cements his break with former President Trump. Pence was speaking Friday evening to the party's top donors at a gathering in New Orleans. Pence has been working to differentiate himself from Trump as he lays the groundwork for a possible 2024 presidential run. It's 6:32. Michelle Murray is in the WMAL Traffic Center this morning.
In Bethesda, watch out for a long-term work zone on Wisconsin Avenue northbound between Bradley Boulevard and Montgomery Lane, and that takes up the right lane. And southbound on the Rockville Pike between Woodmont Avenue and Stanford Street, you will find right lane construction as well. In Upper Marlboro, keep in mind that Pennsylvania Avenue northbound, the ramp to go onto northbound Ritchie Marlboro Road, is closed for emergency road work. Now from GarageRepair.com, the WMAL Stormwatch 7 forecast.
Temperatures will really warm as we head towards the weekend highs today into the low and mid-60s. We will see some morning clouds followed by afternoon sunshine. Later on tonight, mostly cloudy skies. Low temperatures not really going to drop, mainly into the 50s to near 60 degrees. For your Sunday, very warm. Temperatures into the mid-70s under mostly cloudy skies. Have the chance for some isolated showers. Better chance for rain as we head towards Monday, late afternoon and evening. Ahead of a cold front, high temperatures on Monday near 80 degrees. I'm 7 News meteorologist Alex Liggett in the Stormwatch 7 Weather Center.
34 degrees in the nation's capital, 6:33 on the Saturday morning update.
Be a part of the conversation and stay informed.
Follow WMALDC on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook.
Saturday morning update. It's good to have you with us. I'm Rick Fowler. Jennifer Harper with us every weekend. She writes Inside the Beltway at the Washington Times. Good morning.
Well, good morning, Rick.
Well, of course, Ukraine and Russia dominating the news this week, and a lot of talk about the Cold War, and you follow the media very closely. So what is striking you about things this week?
Well, there are a lot of people who are revisiting the Cold War this week for all the obvious reasons. There are people who are suddenly recalling that they grew up in the atomic age when they were doing duck and cover exercises and so forth and so on. So that's kind of been on people's collective consciousness. And but you have to also wonder whether Russia President Vladimir Putin is also revisiting the days of the Soviet Union and the USSR. And I pose this to somebody who might know, and that is Harry J. Kazianis. He is the senior director of the Center for National Interest. He's the executive editor of their publication, The National Interest. And I said, you know, people are wondering about Putin's strategy. Do you think he's revisiting the Cold War era, et cetera? Here's what he said to me. He said, Putin's motives have always been clear. While, yes, he does miss the days of Soviet power and glory, he realizes that Russia is a country in relative decline, and it has no way to rebuild the USSR. Again, this is coming from Harry Kazianis. He says, however, what he can do is try and redo the map of Europe and Eurasia so as to damage as many old Soviet republics around Russia's borders so Moscow's position is secure. That is why he destroyed Chechnya, invaded Georgia, and now invaded Ukraine not once but twice. And he concludes by saying, Putin does not want to conquer per se, but instead he wants to ensure that Russia's neighbors are a bunch of failed states that Moscow can control and dominate, and that means he will smash Ukraine over at least several weeks to make sure the European Union and NATO won't touch Kyiv for decades to come. So that's a thought about that, kind of, say, disconcerting.
Well, let's turn a 180 on Vladimir Putin and go to the First Lady of Ukraine. Tell us about Olena.
She is such an interesting person. She's just over 40. She's a mother of two, active on social media, and she has really come into instant global focus in the past 72 hours, I guess, as You know, the Russian-Ukraine situation continues. And the news media has been very eager for news about First Lady Alina Zelenska. Just a couple of headlines about her. This is coming from ABC News. While President Zelensky inspires his country in the fight against Russia, his wife is also helping to rally the nation's resistance. Guest of Guests, that's a society publication. They say in the midst of a shocking national crisis, Ukraine's First Lady, Alina Zelenska, has gained the world's admiration as the picture of bravery and composure alongside her husband. And let's move over to People magazine. They say while President Zelensky stands his ground, so does his wife, who is reportedly also still in Ukraine, though the president declined to say where she and their two kids are weathering the Russian attacks. And they've been married since 2003. And they have a teenage girl and 9-year-old boy as their children. And they actually met at their university. This is Mr. and Mrs. Zelensky, actually. And the First Lady trained as an architect. She became a script writer for a comedy troupe. That is how she kind of got to know President Zelensky, because he was one of the cast members. And just to illustrate what kind of lady she is, this is what she posted on her social media sites. I will not have panic and tears, she says. I will be calm and confident. My children are looking at me. I will be next to them and next to my husband and with you. And that was her public message to the citizens of Ukraine. So pretty good. She's got 2 million followers on Instagram.
2 million followers?
Mm-hmm.
Well, we've seen some pretty miserable poll numbers for President Biden. Any improvement there?
No. To answer you very quickly, no. We've got one more. Well, I hit you with one poll this morning. There are always a million out there. But this is coming from the Terrence Group. They are a strategic research and polling firm. They do some work for the Republican Party. And they have a new term for us, Rick. It's called the Biden drag. Kind of sounds like a 1920s dance of some sort, but the polls are just showing that he's just dragging in the polls. And they say even the bargain bin public polls reflect the weakened position President Biden is in with voters. The free fall in approval he experienced in August and September of last year has not bounced back, and in fact has continued into it more decline. This poll has him at 53% majority disapproval, 41% approval. Again, this is coming from the Terrence Group. And they say that number is even more extreme among independent voters, 55% disapproval, 37% approval. And what has been less covered, but in fact much worse for President Biden and the Democrats' chances in November, is the waning intensity of that remaining support. Voters strongly disapprove of the president at a rate of over 2-1 of those who strongly approve. And as our listeners know, probably this is going to be close, but Republicans still seem to have the edge. And it's that voter enthusiasm and engagement that seem to be coming into play here. And certainly the Terrence Group poll affirms this. This is 800 registered U.S. voters conducted February 10 through 7 and released on Tuesday.
And I'm not sure if this is going to help his poll numbers or hurt him, but how long did the president speak the other night, and how long did it feel like?
Well, it maybe felt like 3 years for some people, but the ever-vigilant C-SPAN has long kept a tally of how long the president spoke during their first State of the Union address over the years. It's kind of a little historical thing. But Mr. Biden spoke 62 minutes on the nose. Again, this is according to our friends at C-SPAN. And just in contrast, when former President Trump spoke for his first time, he spoke for 80 minutes and 32 seconds. Barack Obama spoke for 69 minutes, 20 seconds. George W. Bush, 47 minutes, 50 seconds. Bill Clinton, 63 minutes, 49 seconds. George H.W. Bush, 35 minutes and 41 seconds. And we'll end that with Ronald Reagan, who spoke for 40 minutes and 5 seconds and probably said more than all of them put together. But there you go.
When was the last time you went to the grocery store? Obviously, inflation is whacking us all, but it is hitting in other places, too. What are you finding?
Well, I had to stop at all of this because there is huge inflation in the babysitting business. Yes, this is just another form of inflation, but there are people that track these kind of things. And there's kind of a babysitting bonanza going on right now. The average hourly rate for a babysitter is up by 11% since last year. It is $20.57 an hour. That's just for one child. And this is far outpacing the 7% rate of inflation. And this is coming from Urban Sitter. They compile data about people who hire babysitters because they're sort of an agency which does that in 60 different cities. So they this is based on data from about 10,000 U.S. families. So, again, the price of babysitters is up by 11%. Here's some of the figures. The national average rate for child care is $20.57 for one child, $23.25 an hour for two, $24.35 an hour for three. The New York area, oh, surprise, has the highest rates in the nation. That's $23.45 an hour for one child. Gosh, maybe we should be babysitters, Rick. Anyway, going on to San Francisco, where it's $23.32, and Seattle at $21.23. The lowest rate of all for babysitters, San Antonio, Texas, $14 an hour for one kid. One other thing, vaccinated sitters get higher wages. So that's kind of a sign of our times or something. Not sure.
Jennifer Harper, Inside the Beltway at the Washington Times, as always. Thank you very much. You can follow her on Twitter at Harper Bulletin.
My pleasure, Rick. Have a good weekend, everybody.
You too. 6:42, it's the Saturday Morning Update on WMAO. We'll talk with Jim Trustee next. A couple of interesting stories, including a judge who will be going on trial in Massachusetts after she let an immigrant out the back door so that ICE wouldn't arrest them. Fascinating story. That's next. Right now, Michelle Murray's in the WMAL Traffic Center.
So far, traffic on the Beltway is moving at speed throughout Virginia and in Maryland through Montgomery and Prince George's County. In Prince George's County, on the outer loop at Allentown Road, you will still find a work zone along the left side. However, that is not causing any delays at this time. In the district, keep in mind that a portion of L Street is closed between K Street and 14th Street in Southeast for water repairs. And on 66 inbound and outbound at the Roosevelt Bridge, there is some long-term emergency road work taking place, and only two lanes get by in each direction. Now from GarageRepair.com, the WMAL StormWatch 7 forecast.
Temperatures will really warm as we head towards the weekend highs today into the low and mid-60s. We will see some morning clouds followed by afternoon sunshine. Later on tonight, mostly cloudy skies. Low temperatures not really going to drop, mainly into the 50s to near 60 degrees. For your Sunday, very warm. Temperatures into the mid-70s under mostly cloudy skies. Have the chance for some isolated showers. Better chance for rain as we head towards Monday, late afternoon and evening. Ahead of a cold front, high temperatures on Monday near 80 degrees. I'm 7 News meteorologist Alex Liggett in the StormWatch 7 Weather Center.
34 degrees in the nation's capital. We're at 6:44 on the Saturday Morning Update.
News Talk 105.9 WMAL.
Making sense of the news.
It's the Saturday Morning Update. Thank you for being with us. I'm Rick Fowler. Jim Trustee joins us, partner at IFRA Law here in Washington, and he is the former chief of the Organized Crime and Gang Section at the U.S. Department of Justice. Jim, good morning.
Good morning, Rick.
Big headline this week, Trump engaged in criminal conspiracy to defraud the U.S. That, according to the January 6th Select Committee. Now, what does that mean exactly when they come to that conclusion?
Well, it means they're highly politicized, for one thing, but it doesn't mean much yet for Donald Trump or for anyone close to him. I mean, this committee is clearly acting like they have a verdict in search of evidence. You know, they are they haven't done much that's public yet. What they're shooting for, what they're obviously teeing up here, is a criminal referral, and that's what you get from these congressional committees and subcommittees, is if they think they've proven up a crime, or in this case, if they know they have because it's Donald Trump, they'll send a referral, a formal package over to the local U.S. Attorney's office, in this case, Washington, D.C., and they'll say, look at all this great evidence we have from all these tremendous sources, and we think it's clear the person's guilty of a crime. But then the U.S. Attorney's office looks at it, probably in conjunction with the attorney general in a case like this, and they make a decision whether there's actually a crime or not.
So what types of criminal activity would rise to the level that DOJ would take any action?
So the referrals can be for almost anything. Remember Andy McCabe, when he was the second in charge of the FBI during all of this anti-Trump Russia investigation stuff, his false statements, repeated false statements, including to the inspector general themselves, all of that was referred to the D.C. U.S. Attorney's Office, and then it died a quiet death. So it's not the high end of the offense. It's just a false statement referral. But they're supposed to consider it fairly and decide whether or not the equities lie in prosecuting. They didn't do it there, but it'll be very interesting to see if there's a formal referral here, whether the AG weighs in and whether the D.C. U.S. Attorney's Office will be particularly aggressive or circumspect.
So I guess, Jim, depending on what media outlets you follow, this will have more significance on some than others. I guess you've seen some different perspectives.
Yeah, typically that's the case around Washington, D.C., no matter what the issue. But here, what I've been noticing is the coverage has been decidedly coming from the left. And CNN ran an article this week that was just so full of praise for Adam Schiff. It called the committee industrious for coming up with things like subpoenaing Kimberly Guilfoyle, the girlfriend of Donald Trump Jr. Yeah, they are predetermining that this is the greatest commission in the history of commissions, and that even though DOJ already brags about charging 750 people with crimes from January 6th, that, you know, this committee is going to bring the heads of several others. And I have to say that, to me, really the most frustrating missed opportunity to do something good, and we've talked about this before, Rick, although it's been a while, I think what would be a better service in terms of this committee is to not just focus on, you know, Donald Trump's head, but to get into the dynamics of civilian police response and reactions. You know, we have a lot of people charged with assaulting police officers, and I have to tell you, I don't lose any sleep over those folks being prosecuted. If you assault a cop, you know, conservatives and everyone else should be consistent that that is a red line that we're going to strictly enforce. But I would like to have a little bit more information about the Capitol Police response to the chaos of that day. I mean, there is clearly inconsistent use of deadly force. I think the Ashley Babbitt investigation, whatever the merits of it, it was handled awfully quietly. You know, we've had high-profile police-related shootings across this country that had so much more public scrutiny permitted by the prosecutors, whether they chose to charge or not charge. And I think that's a case where it would have been helpful and interesting and maybe a good lesson for the future of law enforcement to get it all out there and to really explore that fully. So I think we're missing that because we've got a, you know, politically animated committee with people like Adam Schiff, who is, again, repeating over and over that he's a former federal prosecutor, which causes a reaction of hives in me because of the way he conducts himself. But I don't think they're going to get to the point, you know, bottom line, where they have presented enough evidence that would allow for an actual indictment of Donald Trump or people close to him.
If you're not projecting Trump to be charged, what are you basing that on?
I think primarily it's the indictment we saw a few weeks back of seditious conspiracy. It's the highest, most serious felony indictment we've seen from January 6th. It took over a year to get to that point. These are the promise keepers, the oath keepers, I should say. And if you look at that indictment carefully, and I know you and I did when we talked about it when it came out, there's a paragraph that specifically says these guys, the high-end kind of most actionable defendants from the day, were frustrated that Donald Trump had no connection to their behavior and was not doing anything to foment violence. So they said, literally, we're taking this into our own hands because Trump won't do anything. Well, that's exculpatory. That's a huge moment for DOJ to put that in an indictment, and it tells me that they've kind of topped out with their investigation. Not absolute here, but I think it's a pretty safe, decent guess that the highest type of indictment that's going to come from this case has already come down.
Major decision by the Supreme Court this week affects the future of Dzhokhar Tsarnaev, the Boston Marathon bomber. Jim, tell us about that decision.
Sure. Well, we have Justice Thomas authoring a majority opinion and a 6-3 decision that overturned the lower court, the Court of Appeals, which had reversed the death penalty verdict. So that basically means Tsarnaev goes back into the queue as someone who has been sentenced to death. Now, he'll still have various appellate-type things that have to be exhausted. We have a federal stay on executions that accompanied Mr. Garland becoming the attorney general. So, you know, don't hold your breath for finality in this thing anytime soon. But on the direct appeal level of these huge issues, it turned out to be a good day for the government. Now, it's interesting, on there's two issues that led to the reversal. The first is just that the trial court was insufficient in its questioning of prospective jurors about their knowledge of the case. And you can imagine in the Boston area, everybody knew something about the Boston Marathon bombings. And what Justice Thomas said, and he's quoting another case called Skilling, is he said, being impartial does not mean ignorant. You don't have to literally be a cave dweller who's never heard of anything to qualify for a jury if you can set aside the public information and just go with what happens in the court. And that's a bedrock principle of jury selection. I think it was very good for the Supreme Court to emphasize that again at the expense of a fairly activist court that had reversed the conviction. And the other part of it was in the penalty phase, in the death penalty trial, the defense wanted to introduce what was literally just a rumor that the dead big brother of Dzhokhar Tsarnaev had participated in a triple murder. Now, he had never been charged. There was not much evidence. In fact, the only living participant died when he attacked the police in an interview room on that event. But it was something that they wanted to throw it in front of the jury to say the big brother was really scary and poor little Dzhokhar didn't really know what he was doing when he planted bombs behind 8-year-old kids and did all the things they did. It was not an abuse of discretion, is what the Supreme Court said, for the trial court to rule that the jury doesn't hear it. And again, these are kind of bedrock principles that you give some deference to the trial court on these discretionary calls. And I think what is underneath all of this, Rick, is the First Circuit opinion, when it overturned the conviction, ended with what I think was a blatant note of judicial activism. And I have to think that stuck in the craw of the conservatives on the Supreme Court. They literally had a quote that said something like, Tsarnaev will undoubtedly die in prison. The only question is whether the government will insist on accelerating that fact. And if you notice from all that phrasing, it's literally saying, you know, big government, why would you dare kill this guy? Or why would you try to execute him? He's already got a life sentence. And, you know, again, if you believe at all in the death penalty, and I'm not saying everyone should or everyone would, but Tsarnaev is a pretty good case for it in terms of all of his behavior when it comes to killing innocents, police officers, scrawling jihadi sentiment on the boat where he was captured. There's a lot of aggravating evidence on that young man, and I think the Supreme Court had a reasonable and a good moment in assessing the reversal of his death penalty verdict.
Another story out of Massachusetts that caught your eye involves Immigration and Customs Enforcement officers and a trial judge. Tell us what happened there.
Yeah, this is a crazy story from a couple of years ago that finally resurfaced. It was a judge named Shelley Richmond Joseph and her courtroom deputy who have been charged with obstruction-type offenses. They had a pretrial appeal, which is kind of unusual, saying that the judge has judicial immunity and that whatever she did on this particular day is not something that she could ever be held accountable for. Well, what she did is she had a criminal trial going on. I think it was a drug possession case, maybe a fugitive charge too. And an ICE agent showed up and said, hey, this guy's been kicked out of the country twice before. So when you're done with him today, we're going to take him into custody and get him deported for the third time. Well, the judge apparently didn't like that. So she set in motion a ruse where her clerk told the ICE agent after the criminal case had been disposed of, oh, just go down to the lobby. Mr. Defendant has to go pick up his property in the basement, and then they'll bring him up to the lobby for you to take him. Instead, the judge said to her deputy clerk, take your swipe card and let the illegal alien out the back door. And that's exactly what happened. This guy escaped only because a very activist judge and her courtroom deputy decided they were going to make sure the ICE agent couldn't get their hands on a twice-removed illegal alien with a new criminal case. So, you know, to me, there's activism and then there's activism. This one certainly got to the level of criminal activism, and she'll finally stand trial after this pretrial appeal is denied, and we'll keep an eye to see how serious other judges take the judicial conduct at the heart of this case.
So the judge will be going on trial.
The judge is going on trial, and if I'm her lawyer, I'd say bring a toothbrush.
Took me a second, but I got that one, Jim. Jim Trusty, partner at IFRA Law here in Washington, as always, thank you so much. You can follow him on Twitter at Trusty Lawyer.
All right, thanks. Have a good weekend.
See, the idea there is some folks didn't get that. Well, the idea is that the person being spoken of may be doing a little time away from home, so to speak. Anyway, we're coming up on the 7 o'clock news with Heather Curtis. Then we're back with John Gizzi. And among the topics we'll talk about with John, of course, President Zelensky of Ukraine. We'll talk about the latest on President Biden and the State of the Union address, put that in perspective. And some interesting developments in Texas politics. Three races down there, and you're familiar with the names. Beto O'Rourke, Greg Abbott. There was a gubernatorial primary contested race on the Republican side. We'll get the results of that from John Gizzi this morning, and also kind of a surprise exit for a Texas Republican congressman. That's all coming up. And also we're going to be talking with Cheryl Atkinson, and she's got some perspectives on congressional earmarks. They're coming back just when we thought we'd gotten rid of them. And also her perspectives on the coverage of Ukraine and the reports coming out of Ukraine. We'll get into that with Cheryl this morning. Lieutenant Colonel Tony Schaefer is on the way. We'll ask him about the no-fly zone controversy. You know, of course, President Zelensky has been requesting it. And NATO has so far said, no, we do not want to provoke a war with Russia. So what can we do? What more can we do? We'll ask Tony Schaefer that question. And then we'll talk with K.T. McFarland, and we're going to ask her kind of from the foreign policy and international political side, where do we go next with Vladimir Putin in this crisis in Ukraine? That's all coming up on the Saturday Morning Update. One note, if you would like some humorous reading over the weekend, you can check out the Washington Post and the Associated Press fact-checking on President Biden's speech the other night. I think you'll get some chuckles. It is 6:58 on the Saturday Morning Update.
WMAL-FM, Woodbridge, Washington, a Cumulus Media station.
Making sense of the news.
News Talk 105.9.